morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Bacon Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to the very wonderful folks from the Conservation Voters of New Mexico and also from the ACLU. Right now, I'd like to welcome Sherry Hooper. She is the executive director of the Food Depot. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you.
Now, the Food Depot is an organization that's been around Santa Fe for quite some time, serves northern New Mexico.
Mm-hmm, that's right. We were founded in 1993, and we are the food bank for northern New Mexico. And really, I think a lot of people think, what exactly is a food bank? And it's really very simple. In the whole Hunger Relief Network, the food bank serves as the food supplier, meaning that we go out, we get donations of food. We're actually having to purchase more food now because of the need continues to grow. And then what we do is we supply agencies that have food programs. Those include emergency food pantries, soup kitchens, shelters, senior centers, youth programs, really quite a large variety. 100 agencies count on us for their food.
So people don't actually come to you. They come to these other agencies.
Most of the time. We do have individuals who find us, and what we'll do is we'll make sure that they are served. And then what we do is we make sure that they have a resource guide that gives them information on where they can get food more consistently, where they can sign up for food stamps, they might be able to get utility assistance, all sorts of other things.
And so how bad is the hunger problem in northern New Mexico, and is it getting better, is it getting worse?
You know, it's increased slightly over the last year. We're seeing that of the 100 agencies we serve in 7 counties, each quarter now they're reporting helping about 80,000 people. And some of those are duplicated numbers. We know that much. But that's up from about 75,000 this time last year.
And what are the reasons for people seeking food? Is it just wages are so low, unemployment? What's going on?
Well, I think it's all of those things. There are our seniors who are seeking help. The cost of fuel, for example, the cost of food, all of those things continue to rise. We're also seeing seniors, many seniors are coming to us because they're having to raise their grandchildren. And they're having to do that on, obviously, Social Security and things like that. In fact, I just had a woman come to me this week, ask for food, and she said, I just got my 3 grandchildren, and I don't know how I'm going to make it.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's a growing population, the seniors in the state.
What's happening with the parents of these children?
I think oftentimes they're absentee, for one. I think we also have parents who are battling drug and alcohol addictions, different things like that.
So you've got grandparents and you've got all sorts of problems. How does it compare in the cities like Santa Fe, Albuquerque, Los Alamos, and so on versus the countryside?
Well, I think there's greater poverty in different counties around the state. You know, you have higher poverty in some of the western counties like McKinley County, for example. But right here in the 7 counties we serve, there's very high poverty in certain counties like Mora, for example, and Rio Arriba County. So, we're seeing there are pockets of people that are seeking help more often or their numbers are growing. We're also seeing, I wanted to add, working families. I think that dispels a real myth about hunger and that people are just too lazy to work, so they're seeking help. And that isn't true. We're finding that more than half the households who are helped through a food bank agency have at least one adult working. And what we're finding is they have this fixed income, this income each month from their job. They have fixed expenses like paying the utility bills to keep the heat on, paying rent or mortgage to make sure they keep a roof over their family's head. So all of these are fixed. And what is the easiest piece of their budget to work with is their food budget. So once they paid all those other bills, they're finding more and more that they don't have much left over for food. So they're seeking help at a food pantry or a soup kitchen.
I would think that an issue would not only be food, but healthy food. But, of course, you know, the easiest way to get cheap calories is through food that's not that good for you, fatty food.
Well, that's exactly right. What they do when people have, you know, not a lot of food and they have some food stamps perhaps, they go into a grocery store and what they do is they have to look at what they can buy cheaply that is filling. And more often than not, that's calorie-dense food. It's not nutrient-dense food. So what we're trying to do at the Food Depot is we're trying to provide as much fresh fruits and vegetables as we can so that people have access to more nutritious food.
Where do you get your food?
Oh, we get it from so many different sources. Nationally, we're a part of the America's Second Harvest Network, which is the National Food Bank Network. We get food from that source. On the state level, we have a contract with Human Services, and so we distribute commodities, the government foods, for the Human Services Department. It's a wonderful partnership.
What kind of food comes from the government?
Well, it's a lot of, you know, the plain label things, but it's mostly non-perishable food. Once in a while, we get some fresh produce through it. But for the most part, it's things like pinto beans, rice, lots of staple foods, canned juices, canned meats, things like that. It's
right.
A wonderful program, and that we're so fortunate to be a part of it because that provides anywhere from 30 to 50,000 pounds of food through the Food Depot each month.
One thing that always strikes me in restaurants and just in observing life as you go through it is how much food is wasted in this society. Is there any way to see to it that somehow that food isn't wasted but rather goes to those who need it?
Well, actually, that's why food banks were started. Long, long ago, 1979, I believe, the first food bank was started. And it was because a man had witnessed a mother going through a dumpster to get food for her children. And, you know, he thought there's got to be a better way to get that food that's going into dumpsters but still perfectly good to people who needed it. So he started food banking, and that's what we're about. I mean, we here locally, we go to grocery stores, to bakeries, to restaurants, and we pick up food that they have not sold, that may be day old, and maybe the produce has a bruise on it and it's not quite of the quality they want on their shelves. Nationally, large manufacturers will donate if they've overproduced items, if the items have been damaged, but the actual food is still good. They may have tested an item on the market and it didn't sell, so they pull it off the shelves and donate that. So that's what we're about. What we're finding is that is not enough, those types of donations. And so food banks are having to do a lot more purchasing of food.
Oh, boy.
Which, of course, is driving up our costs of doing business.
And so you have to fundraise.
We do have to fundraise. And
that leads us into
it's perfect. What a segue. We are fundraising, and we get our donations from many sources. Individuals in this community are so very generous. We have businesses who support us, foundations, you name it. But we have a way on Saturday for everyone in this community to be engaged in this battle against hunger, and it's our Super Bowl event.
And super spelled S-O-U-P-E-R, ladies and gentlemen.
There we go. So we're not really about football so much, but
is this also the football weekend?
It is.
Okay.
And you will always find that our Super Bowl event falls on the same weekend as the big Super Bowl. Yes. So
which is more fun? You decide.
Well, you know, yes, exactly. But I think our event's way more fun, especially since my Packers didn't get into the Super Bowl. But anyway, this weekend, this Saturday is Super Bowl, and it's our 14th year. It's going to be from 12 to 2. And we're holding it at the College of Santa Fe Driscoll Fitness Center. Tickets to get in are $25 at the door, $10 for children 6 to 12. Or you can get them in advance by either dropping by our office or going online.
Where is the Food Depot?
We're located at 1222 Siler Road.
So what happens at this event? I mean, there's all sorts of soups and all sorts of bowls.
Yes, exactly. We don't give you a straw, so you have to have bowls.
Spoons. There are spoons.
Spoons, too, are involved. You know, it's great. We have about 24 restaurants this year. And what they do, you know, the chefs really get into it. They experiment. They come up with incredible recipes for new soups. Many of them do. And then they serve it up that day. All of those restaurants compete in one of four categories. And then all of them compete for the overall best soup of Santa Fe. And when guests come in, they're handed a ballot. They walk around and sample soups from all the restaurants, and they place their votes for their favorite soups in the categories in which the restaurants are participating, so are competing. They have a lot of fun. People are into it. I have people who come every year for 10 years. They said, you know, there are rules you follow. You don't bring in a purse. It gets in your way. You don't wear a coat in because that gets in your way. You want to have your hands free, you know, and they just have a lot of fun with it.
It's sort of a sporting event.
It is a sporting event. Here's the thing. We have this huge scoreboard, and we keep track. So every time a restaurant has 7 votes, they get a touchdown. And we have these little footballs on this big scoreboard, and we show the how each restaurant's doing during the event. And then we have our announcers, and they announce when a restaurant gets a touchdown. So it keeps the atmosphere real lively and festive and and fun. And people, like I said, people are into it.
So just looking back on past Super Bowls, what have been some of your favorite soups?
Oh, my gosh. You know, it's, that's a hard one. I like corn soups. One time,
You're a Midwestern girl.
I am a Midwestern girl. One time, La Plazuela did a split pea soup that was so good and fairly simple, but incredibly good. You never know what you're going to get. Sometimes the restaurants get really fancy and they have all these things they put on top of the soup and hand it to you, and we'll just have to see. But I was tempted to bring the list of the soups, the names of the soups, to give you some idea, but, you know, it should be a surprise. You'll have to come to the event and see.
But some of the leading chefs in Santa Fe are making them.
Absolutely. We have restaurants. I can run through a quick list. We have Aldi La, which is their first year with us, so it's exciting. Baleen at the Inn and Spot Loretto. We have the Bamboo Asian Cuisine, which is also a new restaurant in town. Bon Appetit, Cafe Pasquale's, they are wonderful. They've participated year after year. First year for Cafe Cafe. We have the Cowgirl Barbecue coming back. We have Dinner for Two coming back. Last year they won one of the awards. El Farol, Joe's Diner. We have Kingston Residents of Santa Fe, which is, they've been the last couple of years. La Boca, which is
great.
Fairly new. Yeah, they were here last year. La Casa Cena. They won last year the overall best soup with their red chili chocolate soup.
So it's a veritable walk through the restaurants of Santa Fe, essentially.
Absolutely. You know, and it's all sorts of types of restaurants and, you know, levels of restaurants, real high-end versus not. And I think that the people who are there representing the restaurants have a lot of fun with it, too.
And for more information on this, people can call 471-1633 or they can visit thefooddepot.org. Getting back to the work of the Food Depot, have you gotten into the whole question of genetically modified foods?
We have not at this point, but we know it's coming because we, again, it's those sorts of things where if it's something they're testing and it's not selling, but it's still good, they can donate that. So we're having to really take a look at that and see if that's coming our way, and I expect it is.
So you also provide food for people of natural disasters. That's one of the things it says on your... Have we had natural disasters for which you had to provide food lately?
Not too much lately, luckily. The Cerro Grande fire several years ago was a huge project for the food bank. And unfortunately, we weren't in the building we're in now, so it was even more of a challenge to really meet that huge need. We're in a new... It's not new anymore. We've been there for about 6 years. And so we're better prepared at this point with space and trucks and all of those things to handle something that size. We've had, since I've been here for 6 years, we've had some smaller fires where we've helped to feed the firefighters, for example, and we've helped to feed the victims of the disaster at the shelters, for example. We partner with American Red Cross, with Salvation Army, and with some of the other nonprofits who do any kind of disaster relief work.
Now, do you take food donations from the public?
Absolutely. People
walk in every day. Does that make a significant difference?
You bet it does. And what happens is, I had a man walk in yesterday. He was coming in for a meeting, and he brought us a case of canned soup, which was wonderful, especially for the winter. And what people don't realize is how important that donation is, because those are types of items that we don't always get from our other donations.
Right.
So individuals bringing food in, or if a business or a school or a religious organization has a food drive, that usually provides the non-perishable food that we're not getting from other sources.
Right. Well, anything else that you want to let us know about the Food Depot?
Well, you know, we continue to grow, and it's actually an amazing organization. And
which is kind of a double-edged. I mean, it's not. You want to be able to say that you are out of business because there's no more hunger problems.
Right. We'd love to see that. And the staff, we always say, hey, wouldn't it be great to be out of a job because there were no more hungry people in this community? And we firmly believe that. We see that there are opportunities with regard to changing policy over the years, local policy, state policy, and federal, so that it starts to pull people out of the poverty cycle. So we want to work towards that, but at the same time, we want to make sure that people have access to good, healthy, nutritious food. So we'll continue to do what we're doing.
Now, do you work on the policy front, for example, during the legislature?
We do, absolutely.
What are you working on this session?
Well, what we're working on is, for example, funding to help the New Mexico Association of Food Banks make sure that we get that healthy produce into the food banks. That's one of the programs we're working on. I'm probably a little premature in announcing this, but it was yesterday was a great day for us. I have been working with some others in the community, Tony McCarty at Kitchen Angels, for example, Mark Winnie, Pam Roy, who's with the New Mexico Food and Ag Policy Council, and Farm to Table. We've been working at the local level to see if we could get the city and the county to work together to develop a food policy advisory council. And I'm happy to report that the city council passed the resolution about 2 weeks ago, and yesterday the county, the Board of County Commissioners passed it. So we're very excited about that because that's a way we can actually affect change locally in policy. It'll bring people together that perhaps haven't worked in the hunger relief area, but it's not just about hunger. This is about making sure that all of our citizens have access to good, nutritious food.
Well, Sherry Hooper, Executive Director of the Food Depot, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Sandy Buffett. She is Executive Director of Conservation Voters of New Mexico and CVNM Education Fund. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
Now, this is the big time of year for you, the legislative session. First of all, what is Conservation Voters of New Mexico?
Sure. Well, Conservation Voters of New Mexico, or CVNM, is the political voice of New Mexico's conservation community. And our mission is to make the protection of air, land, water, wildlife, and our communities a top priority for all elected officials, for political candidates running, and for voters across the state. And we do this by serving as the full-time voice over at the Roundhouse, our state capitol building, for the environment. And we also do a scorecard every year, scoring the legislators on how they're voting on environmental bills. And then we endorse candidates, and through our Connected Political Action Committee, we actually work to elect pro-conservation candidates.
Now, what are you working on this year in the legislature? There's some serious priorities that you have.
Yeah, well, we're midway through the 30-day session, and although it is a budget session, which means that only bills that are appropriations or that come down from a message from the governor get to be heard. But in the last year, we convened members of the New Mexico environmental community that engage at the legislature. We brought together over 20 organizations representing 30,000 New Mexicans to really define a set of priorities that the whole environmental community could get behind. And the reason we do this is so that we convey a clear message to legislators as to what we expect of them. And then really that gives them nowhere to hide, too. So we set a list of priorities. And the first one of those is the Leave No Child Inside Act. I don't know if you've heard about this one. Sierra Club's done a great job of helping to push this. And that bill will generate revenue for children's outdoor education.
And I love that the revenue is generated from a tax on the sale of video games and TVs.
Exactly.
It's perfect.
Take the source of the problem, kids being inside way too much, they spend more hours in front of TV screens and video games than they do in school, and certainly more time than they do getting outdoors.
Is that right? More than they do in school? They're in school all day.
I know. Well, studies show that, and you know, kids are really on an unhealthy trend. New Mexico youth are experiencing more obesity, and we just need to get them outside so that they can have the same experience as we had as kids. Just, you know, go outside and run around for 8 hours. And
I really never thought that I would get to the point where I would say, when I was young, it was different.
Yeah, that's right.
But it really was. We were free, and we ran around.
We sure did, and we got to run around in the mesas and in the bosque, and you know, for the future of our leaders, it really matters if they have formative experiences in the outdoors as well. Otherwise, when they become legislators and governors, if they have no affinity for nature, then we're really lost in terms of strong environmental protection. So
how do you get the kids out of the house and tear them away from their little addictive toys?
Well, this bill would have a 1% excise tax on the purchases of new TVs and video games, and that revenue, which is expected to generate about $4 million annually, would go to the State Parks Division. And you know, next year everyone is about to convert over to HD TV, so it's actually a timely moment to, you know, a lot of people are going to be buying brand new plasma TVs, so we want to get this syntax pass this year.
Syntax.
Exactly. And then state parks would work with communities, nonprofit agencies, schools to build community programs for kids during school, after school, et cetera.
I was listening to a broadcast the other day that was talking about the direct relationship between the decline of after-school programs and that kind of outdoor stuff and playgrounds and things like that and parks and the rise of gangs.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it's all connected. You know, we need to make sure that kids have alternatives to gangs and the path that goes. So by getting them outside and hopefully hiking and fishing and exploring the geology, that they'll discover other interests.
And it's certainly no lack of geology and outdoors here in New Mexico.
Right. Well, we sure are blessed, aren't we? Now, the next bill, Leave No Child Inside is HB 583. That's House Bill 583.
And where's that? Where's it at?
It's about to be heard in the House Business and Industry Committee, not our most friendly committee, but our sponsor, Representative Gail Chasey, who's a great ally of ours, will be presenting that in the next couple days in that committee. Now, the next bill that's a priority of ours is amendments to the Efficient Use of Energy Act, also known as the Ratepayers Protection Act. And this is our key global warming bill this year because, you know, what we're saying is that utilities such as PNM need to meet part of their energy demand, 10% by 2020 with this bill, by finding ways to increase energy efficiency rather than building new coal-fired power plants. So this will...
Or even wind-powered or solar power.
Exactly. Wind power, solar power, concentrated solar power. But efficiency is really low-hanging fruit that our state hasn't really tackled. So this would work with the Public Regulation Commission and allow them to set rate structures and incentives for the utilities that make it as attractive to go the energy efficiency route as the build new plants route in terms of how they make money.
So what would that look like?
Well, this would create an entirely new industry of weatherization around the state. You know, the utilities would be investing in weatherization. There's estimates this would create 6,900 new jobs of contractors going out and weatherizing people's homes. And we're also pushing a companion piece of legislation that would provide weatherization for low-income housing as well.
Now, I would think the utilities would be against it because efficiency means they sell less, fewer units of energy.
Right. Well, it certainly has been a negotiation with PNM and the others, but the governor did a great job of bringing everybody to the table and saying this is a priority, and certainly the structure will make incentives so that as a company that needs to generate a profit, that they can find ways to meet their bottom line needs through energy efficiency.
So how does that work? I mean, you get them into the weatherization business themselves?
Well, there is. It's quite a complex thing that the Public Regulation Commission, the PRC, will have to sort out from here on out. But it will allow PNM to put sort of a tariff rider on bills that in the short term will provide a flow of revenue to them, but then they use that money to invest in weatherization. So in the long term, consumers will save money.
So basically paying more to have energy in our bills.
Right, but we see that, but we don't see it when we pay more when they build new plants.
So, good point.
Yeah. Now, an accompanying bill to that is the Smart Investments in Public Buildings, which says, we're putting a lot of our state's capital outlay, the fund that each legislator gets to send back to their district to build new capital investments. So this is building community centers and rec centers all around the state, but right now we don't require them to meet any standard of energy efficiency. So this would say, if you're going to use public money, you need to meet a standard of energy efficiency, and that way you're not strapping communities with large utility bills after the building is built.
Now that seems like a no-brainer.
It does, but it is estimated that 1-2% of that money would then have to be used for those upgrades rather than, say, another few hundred square feet of the building. So we will see some challenge to that. But
we're talking to Sandy Buffett of Conservation Voters New Mexico There's one more bill that you're working on.
Right. This is actually a special funding appropriation. It's in the governor's capital outlay, his budget, and that is $10 million. We asked for $10 million for statewide river restoration funding. It's currently down to $5 million, but we're going to push hard to hold that $5 million. And this would go to the Environment Department and then work with groups. This last year, some river restoration funding went through the Nature Conservancy to help restore the Gila floodplain. And really, you know, rivers are the lifeblood of our state, and we need to bring them back to their natural state and promote, you know, native species. And
this is something we've talked about on this show at different times, but what is wrong with our rivers right now? What kind of, in what ways are they compromised?
Well, you know, the Corps of Engineers over the decades has done various things to our rivers and watersheds, and, you know, they're more like channels or ditches than naturally meandering streams with shallow riffles where fish would lay their eggs. And so it's really returning to that sort of meandering, you know, just more rugged,
natural
state.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because what you have is sort of mechanistic and geometric overlay onto natural systems that doesn't work.
Yeah, and you know, we have cleaner water when rivers are in a more natural state. It's a natural filtration system. We have the ability to support diverse species, and so it's really returning rivers like the Gila River, which is our last free-flowing river in the state, to its more natural state.
So these are all the things that Conservation Voters New Mexico is working on. Are there any other bills that you're watching?
Oh, yeah. Well, one other bill that we like is our own Representative Peter Wirth from here in Santa Fe. HB 248 has sponsored the Oil and Gas Development and Public Health Act, which would move the Oil Conservation Division of our state to actually change its mission to include the protection of public health, safety and welfare and environmental protection.
It seems like another no-brainer.
Yeah, of course. I mean, and the word conservation in the Oil Conservation Division is actually meant the conservation of oil, because this was formed in the 50s. And, you know, some of the folks who've been battling in the Calistoya Basin on the oil drilling there have come to realize that the OCD is really limited in what it can tackle. So Representative Worth's bill is saying, look, we also need to consider, have the OCD have the capacity to measure environmental impact on wildlife habitat, et cetera.
To what extent is the Galisteo Basin drilling question making its way into this legislative session?
Well, that's a great segue to some of the anti-environmental bills we're seeing, and we see dozens of them every year brought by industry lobbyists. But that that's created quite a backlash. You know, the winds that we're seeing with Governor Richardson's recent moratorium, 6-month moratorium, and just really, truly the awareness of what oil and gas, how they're behaving in our state, has led to a proposed set of pit rules, and that was done through the Oil Conservation Division this last fall. Now, the oil and gas industry is seemingly fuming about these proposed pit rules, and they've brought forward a handful of bills that are seeking massive deregulation of the state, as well as just stripping funding of our most important environmental protection agencies. And we actually had a battle just the other day on a bill called SB 57, the Regulatory Process Task Force. And this is so-called regulatory justice brought forward by oil and gas, and saying, you know, we're going to have to leave the state because regulations are too burdensome. And so they want to, they want to have a task force that says we need to look at the impact of these regulations on persons, which they define as partnerships, companies, business trusts, and corporations.
Oh, Lord.
But not looking at the impact or the cost of inaction on our common resources, which is what the regulation is there for in the first place.
Common resources being things like land, water, and air.
Yeah, groundwater, the clean air we breathe, public health, wildlife. And so we feel that this whole package of bills is really trying to create a skewed cost-benefit analysis. And in one sense, you know, they're saying we need a oversight committee that has industry, you know, representation over the regulators that oversee the industry.
That's a lot of layers.
Yes, it is. But so far we have held the line, and that bill was tabled, which means that it was effectively killed.
Okay.
But we have some other bills, some constitutional amendments proposed. And those are quite daunting because if those were to pass, it would go on to the 08 general ballot.
What are some of those constitutional amendments and those bills?
Well, that would say that that declaring that the executive has gone too far in its agency reach in regulating and protecting air, land, and water and public health. And so it would put an amendment on the ballot to allow the legislature to override the rulemaking authority of the executive branch and our agencies.
Boy.
You know, we have a 30-day citizen legislature, and they already have hundreds of bills that they can't hear. And
the executive agencies are full-time.
Full-time, year-round. The legislature granted them the authority, in fact, to monitor things like air quality and to write rules. And if some of these deregulation bills were to pass, it would not only have a huge impact on the environment, but it would mean that rules relating to nursing homes, foster care, trucking industry, restaurant sanitation, that all of these things would first have to be approved by the legislature, each and every one of the rules, before it could be enacted.
Which, I mean, besides being a questionable practice itself, puts a huge burden on people who aren't there very much and who may know far less about those issues than the agencies that regulate them.
Well, you know, I am sure that if they had the time and the staffing, legislators don't have professional staff to serve them, that if they had those things, if we had a year-round legislature, it might be a slightly different scenario. But given what we have in New Mexico and the authority that was granted to agencies to protect public health, safety, and welfare, we really need to let them do their jobs, and they're doing a great job, in fact, especially under Governor Richardson's administration, to really clean up, not let oil and gas just abandon a pit of highly saline and possibly carcinogenic waste on land. And, you know,
that's what they want to do?
Yes. The pit rules would, in this state and across the West, often oil and gas drills on land that's where they own the subsurface mineral right, but not the actual land. So they're claiming that they should be able to leave waste that they deem fine to be left on land that's not even the land they own, that has been, in the city of Lovington in southern...
So wait a minute. I own a piece of land. Somebody else owns the mineral rights. They come onto my land, they drill, and then they leave a huge pit of sludge.
Yes, this is how they currently operate in the Oil Conservation Division. You know, sludge might not be the typical
nasty
situation.
Nasty yuck.
Yeah, not things that you would want to drink or that you would want perhaps your livestock or your dog to drink or to go into your seep into your garden. So another bad bill that we've seen is a memorial on the WIP, White Waste Isolation Pilot Project, and that is to allow a higher grade of waste to be stored at WIP. And that would...
Meaning more radioactive than what's there now.
Right. It would effectively make WIP the next Yucca Mountain. And unfortunately, Representative Jim Trujillo from Santa Fe was the vote that allowed that to pass out of committee in the House Energy Natural Resources Committee.
So he's not making it high marks on your scorecard.
Well, that was a disappointing vote for sure. And so we think if people don't want WIP to be the next Yucca Mountain, they should let, if they're indeed a constituent of Representative Trujillo, to let them know their displeasure about that.
So any other bills that you're watching?
Well, there's also some bills related to TIDS, the Tax Increment Development District. We haven't seen that so much here in Santa Fe.
I love all these acronyms.
I know. But in Albuquerque and Las Cruces, policies passed a few years ago with the idea taken from the East Coast that for brownfield redevelopment, that you would provide certain incentives to developers to come in and redevelop. But that's been, in fact, perverted in some of the peripheral areas, and it's now saying, okay, we're going to have taxpayers subsidize sprawl. So there are quite a few bills related to TIDs that we're going to try and fix, and the bad ones that we're going to try and stop.
So how do you get citizens involved? Because one of the things that's quite wonderful about the New Mexican process in the legislature is that citizens can get involved.
Sure, they can. We find, though, sometimes it's really confusing to, you know, in a 30-day or 60-day session, to if you're just following one or two bills or one or two issues, to find out where things are at. And we were getting, over the last couple years, getting literally hundreds of calls or emails saying, where is this bill at, or are there any bills on wolves, or are there any bills on roadless issues? So we actually said this is an unmet need, and we built a website that we've unveiled this last week called Protect New Mexico, and it's protectnm.org, and it allows people, it's a free service, you can go sign in, and it provides analysis on every bill that has a potential positive or negative environmental impact that's currently being heard at the legislature.
And then people can call their legislators.
Right. And we provide links to who's sponsoring the bill and what media markets serve them. So by clicking on the media market, you can send a letter to the editor to the paper that serves that legislator. And it also just allows you to see... you know, say if you want to find every bill related to water and acequias, you could search by that and then personalize. You can get daily alerts on you know, how those bills are moving and such.
And that's protectnm.org.
Correct.
And Conservation Voters of New Mexico is cvnm.org.
It is.
Sandy Buffett is the executive director of that organization, and people can find out more by calling them at 992-8683.
Right. That's 992-VOTE.
992-VOTE.
Yep.
Well, unfortunately, we were out of time right now. It's wonderful to have you here, and we look forward to hearing more about what you're doing.
Thank you very much. I'm going to head back over to the roundhouse now.
All right. We're going to take another quick break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. And, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to welcome Andrea Joseph. She is with the ACLU, the American Civil... She's not with the ACLU. She is here with us here in the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, and we've been talking to some of the folks from the ACLU about the situation that you have faced in your life that reflects on the domestic partnership bill that is passing through the legislature of New Mexico right now. Welcome.
Thank you. Wonderful
to have you here. Tell us, first of all, your story. You were essentially married, but in New Mexico you cannot be officially married if you're a gay person.
That's correct. Dee and I had been together for 13 years, and we were, in fact, married in a church here in Santa Fe about 5 years ago. And we recently went to Mexico to go on vacation right before Christmas, and on the last day of vacation, on December 22nd, Dee passed away.
And so there you were snorkeling, and she had a heart attack and died in your arms.
Yeah. And we had all the paperwork that we thought we needed. We had wills. We had powers of attorney. We had everything that we thought we needed for all contingencies. But this was a contingency that we just hadn't thought about. And unfortunately... the American consulate's agent needed next of kin to authorize the release of Dee's body to the coroner's office initially and then to the funeral home so that Dee could be repatriated back to the United States. And because...
And if you were a heterosexual married couple, you would have been the next of kin.
I would automatically have been next of kin. But because... our relationship was not recognized, next of kin fell to Dee's 19-year-old son.
And so he was in the United States, had to jump through hoops, but eventually you were able to repatriate your wife's body.
The the hoops were the big issue because it was right before Christmas, and there was an issue of notifying him that his mother had died without me having to make a phone call to him. I wanted his father to tell him in person, and that was going to take at least till the next day. And under Mexican law, if you don't notify them what the intentions are, they will automatically cremate. So we needed to get a hold of Michael, make sure that he was okay, and then he had to pretty close to immediately contact the American embassy, the consulate's agent, and let him know what he wanted done with his mom's body.
So a very difficult time. You, before that, you and your partner Dee were already starting to work on this whole question of domestic partnership in New Mexico.
Yes, we had we'd been contacted to see what we could do to get this legislation passed, and Dee just wanted to do whatever she could to help. And we had things in the works already, and so even though this happened and it's been really difficult, I wanted to make sure that I came up here and spoke in front of the legislature and do what I can to get this bill passed.
Where is the bill at now? This bill has come up before in other legislative sessions and has failed by a very narrow margin.
Right now, it passed yesterday in committee by a vote of 5-4. The next step is the Judiciary Committee, and that's going to be the tough one, getting it through the Judiciary Committee. And if it can pass there, then it will go to the floor of the Senate.
What would the bill actually do? What would it provide that hasn't been provided for couples like you and Dee?
It would provide for people to qualify for health insurance under each other's employment benefits for health insurance coverage. It would provide for next of kin so that domestic partners who cannot afford to hire an attorney to get a will, that would then become automatic the way it is with heterosexual couples. It would provide automatically in the event of a medical emergency that the domestic partner could go in the ambulance, could be allowed into the emergency room, could go into post-op with their partner without having to show powers of attorney.
Have you faced any problems before in your very long-term relationship where if the legal situation had been different, you would have had an easier time?
There have been issues with medical. Dee had surgery last summer, and we had to really make sure that the hospital understood our relationship so that we wouldn't have complications. And then in August, I had knee surgery. And again, we had to kind of go through a lot of hoops to make sure that when I came out of surgery, that that Dee would be allowed to come into the post-operative area.
There are obviously legal problems of the kind you're talking about. Along the way, are you facing people who, as individuals, have a discriminatory attitude toward you as a gay person?
I have not. We lived in Las Cruces since 2000, and we have yet to find anybody in the community that has not been open, and that's Christians, Mormons, Catholics, all denominations, Jews. We have not found anybody who has been hostile to us, and so I think that, you know, the community is willing for this type of legislation to go through.
It's very interesting that the legal reality seems to be so far behind the social reality.
Oh, very much so. I mean, we were openly out in Las Cruces, and you know, neighbors, as they've come and gone, and we've introduced ourselves initially. You know, they might be kind of hesitant. We, for a lot of people, we're the first lesbian couple that they have met that they know about, at any rate. And everybody's come around and just been wonderful.
Now, when you talk to the legislators here in New Mexico during this session, what kind of response are you getting from them?
The legislators, the senators that I've spoken to specifically, have been incredibly caring and shown a lot of respect for the situation that I went through because of our relationship not being recognized.
Now, I think it's important to say that this would also be applicable to heterosexual couples. Anybody who wanted to be in a domestic partnership could be.
Yes.
And so, in any case, so what can people do if they want to support the work that you're doing and support the domestic partnership bill here in New Mexico?
I think the only thing that people can really do is to notify the governor's office that they are in support of this legislation, notify their congressman, and to my knowledge, the Senate Judiciary Committee will hear House Bill 9 on Friday. Now, things always potentially might change, but that certainly... our hope is that it will be heard on Friday and to come and show support to attend the committee meeting.
And have you been to these? Is this the first time that you've done this type of activism in the legislature in New Mexico?
Yes, it is. Dee was, for a while, she was the executive director of CASA, Court-Appointed Special Advocates for Abused and Neglected Children. And so she would come up every year and be involved in the legislative process to get funding. So this was her territory and not necessarily something that I would have been the spokesperson for, but she would have, out of the two of us, she would have been the one that would have talked.
What about your son, the son that you raised together? Is he involved in this kind of thing? He's a young man, a teenager, 19, 20 years old. Has he gotten involved in supporting this?
He has been incredibly supportive. Yesterday he attended the committee hearing with me and held my hand, and just his presence of being there was wonderful. And after the committee meeting, he was very upset with the arguments of the opposition.
What are those arguments?
The main argument is basically biblical in nature.
Oh dear.
And the marriage issue, that marriage should be between a man and a woman, and this legislation specifically does not make this a marriage issue. And, Michael said, it's about fairness and equality, and what this country was founded on was freedom of religion. And all of the opposition, Christian conservatives.
Well, Andrea Joseph, I want to really thank you very much for doing the work you're doing and for spending this time with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you.
And people can find out more about the domestic partnership by going to the ACLU New Mexico website or by tracking the bills, which is, there's a wonderful, if you just use your computer and Google, you can find the New Mexico legislative website, which is a wonderful way of tracking bills. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at KSFR.org. You can email me at radiocafe@KSFR.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting. The website is SantaFeRadioCafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to listen to it, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services, and it's archived about a year back. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz opens with the Concerto for Jazz Band and Symphony Orchestra by Rolf Lieberman, and then features an hour with guest Sasha Berland, who used jazz in creating advertisements. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.